Good morning. You're listening to KYRS Thin Air Community Radio. The program is Praxis. And today I was tossing around a lot of different ideas for the show today and don't have a guest. It's just me in the studio. And I think what I'd really like to talk about, a very broad topic, is science, just in general, because, well, obviously it's very important. It's possibly the most important thing that there is for humans to understand and think about and use as a process, because that's really what it is. So I think that if I were to choose a best science, it would probably be physics, because I think they've probably gone the furthest and it's the most fascinating. But the one that I like the most is biology. So I thought that we'd start off the show today with a little biology lesson, because most folks, unless they're scientists in their daily lives or going to school and studying science, it becomes a little more abstract and something that's not focused on as much. So I thought we'd go through this really fascinating list that I found on a website called io9.com, written by Robert Gonzalez. It's the 10 of the world's deadliest plants and how they kill you. I thought this was a pretty cool article. So number 10, conium, also known as hemlock. Let's start with something you're likely to have heard of. If we're going to talk about poisonous plants, then right at the top of the list should be hemlock, don't you think? Widely known for its uses in ancient Greece as a means of execution, hemlock's most famous victim was the philosopher Socrates, who suffered the effects of the plant's most potent toxin, conine. Ingestion of even small amounts of conine, 6 to 8 leaves, or an even smaller dose of the seeds or roots usually does it, causes death by disrupting your body's neuromuscular junctions, resulting in what's known as ascending muscular paralysis. The paralysis typically begins in a person's legs and ascends up the body until it reaches the respiratory muscles, resulting in death. Number 9.5, hemlock again, cicuta, aka water hemlock, death of man, poison parsnip. Members of the genus Cicuta belong to the same family of plants as the hemlock that did in Socrates, and their toxic effects are so harrowing they warrant an appearance on this list as well. There are 4 species belonging to the genus, and all of them are extremely poisonous. The plants contain a compound called cicutoxin, a chemical that's most concentrated in the plant's root system. These roots, when pulled freshly out of the ground, are often mistaken for edible plants like parsnip. Now parsnips have officially become terrifying. Number 9. Oleander. This shrub is one of the most dangerous on the list, which is bizarre on account of how widely it's used as a decorative shrub. This bush pops up in parks, schools, and backyards all over the country, especially in the southern and western regions of the U.S. And while it might be nice to look at, don't go chewing on any part of it. Its leaves, flowers, and all fruit all contain chemicals known as cardiac glycolides, which, while therapeutic in precise doses, can put you into cardiac arrest if ingested unsystematically. Since we all know children are not known for ingesting things unsystematically, let's plant them at schools. That's a great idea. Number 8, aconitum, aka monk's hood, wolf's bane, and devil's helmet. I think I've seen this around Washington. It's kind of a purple hooded looking flower. It's actually very pretty. The poisonous properties of members of the aconitum genus have been known for generations. Several species of the plant, for example, have long been used in preparing poison-tipped arrows for purposes of hunting and warfare. In humans, accidental ingestion can be fatal. The plant contains appropriately named aconitine neurotoxins and cardiotoxins, which lead to gastrointestinal complications, motor weakness, and heart and lung paralysis. Number 7. Ageratina altissima, aka white snake root. No relation to the band White Snake. White snake root is so potent that just drinking the milk or eating the meat of a cow that's ingested the plant can lead to severe sickness and even death. The plant contains a toxin called tremetol, which when ingested can lead to trembling, vomiting, and serious intestinal troubles. The illness brought on by secondary tremetol ingestion was so widespread in the early 19th century that it became known as milk sickness, and is estimated to be responsible for thousands of deaths at the time, including that of Abraham Lincoln's mother, Nancy Hanks Lincoln. Was not vampires. If you saw Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter this summer, it was that pesky white snake root. Number 6, Angel's Trumpet. Botanists will tell you that members of the genus Brugmansia get their nickname Angel's Trumpet from their large hanging trumpet-shaped flowers, which can measure up to 50 centimeters long and 35 centimeters wide at their openings. But we like to think it's named for the trumpeting angels that will herald your arrival in the afterlife. Ingestion of the plant, which contains dangerous levels of the chemicals scopolamine and atropine, is often fatal. This is horrifying because they look just like nasturtiums, which are really delicious edible flowers. Number 5, Diefenbachia, aka dumb cane. Members of the genus Diefenbachia are made up of cells containing microscopic needle-shaped crystals of calcium oxalate, called raphides. When leaves of the Diefenbachia plant are chewed, these tiny spears of calcium oxalate typically lead to oral irritation, excessive drooling, and swelling. In rare cases, irritation becomes so severe that the tongue, mouth, and throat are effectively immobilized, while tissues become so swollen that the airways are blocked, leading to death. Number 4. Abrus precatorius, a.k.a. jequirity, crab's eye, rosary pea. Abrus precatorius is native to Indonesia, where its vibrant black, red, and white beads are often used in the region's percussion instruments. But the seeds are also highly poisonous on account of their abrin content. Abrin, which is chemically similar to the ricin found in castor seeds, sabotages your body's functions at the cellular level by inactivating ribosomes, the molecular machines in your body responsible for synthesizing proteins. The abrin content of just one seed is said to be fatal to humans. Hippomene macinella, a.k.a. manchineal, or manzanilla de la muerte, little apple of death, in Spanish. The manchineal tree does not like company. If you brush up against the tree, the white sap it produces is liable to produce a violent allergic reaction on your skin. Standing beneath the tree during a rainstorm will cause any skin that comes in contact with runoff to blister. These epidermal effects are caused by the powerful irritant phorbol, just one of the many toxins found in the tree's milky sap. Ingesting the tree's fruit is often fatal on account of its physostigmine content, which can lead to complications involving nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and seizures. Basically, don't mess with the manchineal. There's a reason it's called the little apple of death. Number 2, we're getting close to the top 10. Cerbera autolom. Sorry, these Latin names are tripping me up this early in the morning. Also known as the suicide tree. The species of tree belongs to the same family as oleander and is also quite toxic to humans. The seeds of the suicide tree contain a toxin called cerberin, a potent compound capable of disrupting calcium ion channels in heart muscle, which can lead to an irregular heartbeat that is often fatal if the toxin is ingested in high enough quantities. The plant has been referred to by some as the perfect murder weapon. Getting someone to ingest the cerberin in the suicide tree is purportedly easy to do, as its flavor can be disguised by spices when serving in food. The toxin is also notorious for being overlooked as a cause of death in autopsies. It may not come as a surprise, therefore, that a team of French forensic toxicologists concluded that Cerbera odolum is used by more people to commit suicide and murder than any other plant. Number 1. Ricinus communis, aka the castor oil plant. Much like oleander, castor oil plants can be found in houses and gardens all over the world, despite the fact that their seeds are actually very dangerous. So dangerous, in fact, the plant is the current holder of the Guinness Book of World Records title for the world's most poisonous plant. The seeds harbor an incredibly toxic chemical called ricin, and a lethal dose is considered to be in the range of 4 to 8 seeds. Ingestion of the seeds can lead to burning sensations in the mouth and throat, intense abdominal pain, and within 36 hours can lead to death if left untreated. So there's a lot of dangerous plants in the world, and I just think biology is so fascinating, and science in general, and I'm glad that we have a wise government that uses science so well in its doings. And they forgot, I noticed though, when going through this list, that they forgot another plant that's so dangerous, it's illegal, it's federally illegal to grow and consume. It can be used for a lot of things, but despite its positive uses, the negative and dangerous uses far outweigh it. So I decided to look up some information on this 11th plant that should probably be added to the dangerous plants list. It's called a cannabis sativa, also known recreationally as marijuana, and in cannabis plants with a lower concentration of tetrahydrocannabinol, THC, is known as hemp. Cannabis is a popular recreational drug around the world, only behind alcohol, caffeine, and tobacco. In the United States alone, it is believed that over 100 million Americans have tried cannabis, with 25 million Americans having used it within the past year. The psychoactive effects of cannabis are known to have a biphasic nature. Primary psychoactive effects include a state of relaxation and, to a lesser degree, euphoria from its main psychoactive compound, tetrahydrocannabinol. Secondary psychoactive effects, such as a facility for philosophical thinking, introspection, and metacognition, have been reported amongst cases of anxiety and paranoia. Finally, the tertiary psychoactive effects of the drug cannabis can include an increase in heart rate and hunger, believed to be caused by 11-OTHC, a psychoactive metabolite of THC produced in the liver. Normal cognition is restored after approximately 3 hours for larger doses via a smoking pipe, bong, or vaporizer. However, if a large amount is taken orally, the effects may last much longer. After 24 hours to a few days, minuscule psychoactive effects may be felt depending on dosage, frequency, and tolerance to the drug. Various forms of the drug cannabis exist, including extracts such as hashish and hash oil, which, because of appearance, are more susceptible to adulterants when left unregulated. The plant, Cannabis sativa, is known to cause more of a high by stimulating hunger and by producing a rather more comedic or energetic feeling. Conversely, the Cannabis indica plant is known to cause more of a stoned or meditative feeling, possibly because of a higher CPD, cannabidol, to THC ratio. According to the UK medical journal The Lancet, cannabis has a lower rate of dependence compared to both nicotine and alcohol. However, everyday use of cannabis can in some cases be correlated with psychological withdrawal symptoms such as irritability and insomnia, and evidence could suggest that if a user experiences stress, the likeliness of getting a panic attack increases because of THC metabolites. However, cannabis withdrawal symptoms are typically mild and are never life-threatening. A synthetic form of the main psychoactive cannabinoid in cannabis is used as a treatment for a wide range of medical conditions. In the United States, although the FDA does acknowledge that there has been considerable interest in its use for the treatment of a number of conditions, including glaucoma, AIDS wasting, neuropathic pain, treatment of spasticity associated with multiple sclerosis, and chemotherapy-induced nausea, the agency has not approved medical marijuana. In a collection of writings on medical marijuana by 45 researchers, a literature review on the medicinal uses of cannabis and cannabinoids concluded that established uses include easing of nausea and vomiting, anorexia and weight loss. Well-confirmed effect was found in the treatment of spasticity, painful conditions, movement disorders, asthma, and glaucoma. Reported but less confirmed effects include treatment of allergies, inflammation, infection, epilepsy, depression, bipolar disorders, anxiety disorder, dependency, and withdrawal. Basic level research was being carried out at the time on autoimmune disease, cancer, neuroproduction, fever, and disorders of blood pressure. So, upon reading that, this plant cannabis doesn't sound so bad by comparison to those 10 most dangerous plants. In fact, I mean, I'm not going to do a scientific test on this, but it could be used to alleviate some of your symptoms if you ingested some of those less poisonous plants. So I suppose my point here, in going through all this scientific jargon about all of these plants, including cannabis, is the simply unscientific approach that's taken with regulating this substance as a drug. As a fiber, you know, I mean, because of the drug prohibition aspects of this plant, the U.S. has also prohibited the industrial use of the fiber, the oils, and all of the other great products that can be produced with hemp. And in fact, we import over, I believe total hemp imports were $9 or $10 million. In 2011, and it's almost all from China, as you may have guessed. So there's an economic value to this plant that obviously consumers in the U.S. recognize, and yet the very backwards and unscientific government refuses to acknowledge, at least at the federal level. So on Thursday, as you may have heard, in Washington State, recreational use of marijuana became legal. And now it's Monday. An entire weekend has passed. I was on the phone with my grandma, and she asked me if the potheads were out in the streets having a riot, and I really saw no such thing. It might have been a little cold for the potheads to have a party, but all appears to be well in Spokane still, and the world has not fallen apart despite this happening, and I don't think that anyone really thought that it would. The thing that's the strangest to me about marijuana prohibition and prohibition in general is, I think the average person and the average politician and everyone pretty much understands at this point that it doesn't work. Prohibition doesn't work. This law was approved by a 55-45% margin. And I think that a lot of the no votes were actually from marijuana users and people who understand marijuana and its connected issues better than a lot of the people who voted yes. And we'll get into that in a little while. So I would say it's safe to say that 60-70% of the population, unfortunately, you don't get to write in why you voted yes or no on your ballot. So we don't really know. But I would also, from just anecdotal personal evidence, I think that a lot of people who abstained from voting at all are likely marijuana users and supporters. I don't have any science. I don't have any data to back that up other than a handful of people who I know. But we know there's at least a small percentage in the mix who fall into that category too. So I think the majority of people really understand the issue and see that marijuana is not this grave social ill, despite all of the scare talk about, you know, protecting the children and saving the children. And prohibition is the only way to protect these poor innocent children from reefer madness. You know, it really harkens back to the 1950s and 70s. But it's, yeah, like, so my whole point is that it's really a non-scientific perspective on the whole matter. And it's just dumb on every level. I mean, economically, the proposed economic impact of I-502 is supposedly going to bring in, let's find that list I found, fiscal impact, I-502. It's going to bring in a whole bunch of money to the state, but that's not really a positive economic gain in the same sense that being able to produce it industrially in an unregulated manner or a less regulated manner would encourage. So let's see, total, this is from the Liquor Control Board website, fiscal impact of Initiative 502 through fiscal year 2017. Initiative 502 will license and regulate marijuana production and distribution, tax marijuana sales, earmark marijuana-related revenues, and specifically prohibit driving under the influence of marijuana. The total fiscal impact on state and local government revenues, expenditures, and costs is indeterminate due to the significant uncertainties related to federal enforcement of federal criminal laws related to marijuana. However, the initiative's provisions related to driving under the influence of marijuana, which are not affected by federal criminal law enforcement, are estimated to generate known state fee revenue of $4,295,000 and known state agency costs of $2,754,000 over five fiscal years. So just in the state fees for operating, for licensing and regulating marijuana, it's over $4 million. And the total, where did I see this? I read this earlier. Estimated total revenue generated to the state could be as high as $1.94 billion over five fiscal years. So the state has a lot to gain through this program of supposedly legalizing marijuana. It's really regulating marijuana rather than fully legalizing it in the sense of decriminalizing and unregulating, which personally, there's a lot of people within the pro-marijuana community who during this campaign argued that I-502 is an important step forward, and it's a step in the right direction to ending drug prohibition, if they're a little more radical, and marijuana prohibition at all, if they're a little less so. But I don't know if that's the way I see it the more that I look at it. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that later on in the show. And if you have any thoughts on this or information, do feel free to give me a call at 509-747-3807. The real issue that I have with it at the core is that this is a substance that is not significantly harmful when used at any level. There are no recorded deaths. You cannot overdose. I'm not sure. I should look up what the annual death rates caused by alcohol are in Washington state. And I can guarantee you that they're a lot higher than zero. So I think a good way to talk about it is to contrast weed with alcohol, because the effects are different. The social ills attributed to marijuana are often some that can be attributed more accurately to alcohol, including the concept of it as a gateway drug. There's just many layers of propaganda that need to be peeled back that I believe are being peeled back. And it shows in the amount of people who both voted for this law and voted against it because they wanted something better, which I, again, contend that that was a pretty large percentage of the no votes. So in order to talk about this today, I also want to talk about this anti-science policy as part of a larger anti-science push within our governmental structure in the U.S. and culturally in the U.S., the propagation of pseudoscience, occultism. We have higher levels of belief in the occult, in things like that, in unscientific, both religious and otherwise, pseudoscience practices than since the 16th century. So in a lot of ways, there's been a huge decline in critical thought and a big push for this kind of superstitious, mystical, magical thinking that's not substantiated by any evidence. So my favorite person to listen to, read, be inspired by on this topic and many others is Carl Sagan, who is astrophysicist, was, he died in 1996, was an astrophysicist and kind of a science popularizer, but not in the sense of really dumbing down science. He had a real passion for it. And I have a lot of quotes from him that I'm going to kind of use as guideposts for this talk today. And he was just awesome, basically, is all I can really say about Carl Sagan. And I'm drawing a lot from his 1995 book. It's one of his last published works before he died, called The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark. It's a wonderful book. If you haven't read it, it's pretty widely available because he's a popular guy. And chunks of it are available online for free. So this is what Carl Sagan had to say, among other things, about legislating marijuana use and cannabis. He said, the illegality of cannabis is outrageous, an impediment to full utilization of a drug which helps produce the serenity and insight, sensitivity and fellowship so desperately needed in this increasingly mad and dangerous world. So that's Carl Sagan on the topic of marijuana prohibition. I find it really interesting that even the scientific articles about marijuana, it's not people posting on Arrowhead about how it feels so great to get high, you know, but the scientific literature says, you know, produces mild euphoria and a propensity for insight, things like that. Like how, in what kind of world does a substance which, while causing no physical harm, increases your ability for analytical and philosophical insight illegal? I think that says a lot about the society that we live in, that's the thing to go after. But Carl Sagan goes on to say, one of the saddest lessons of history is this. If we've been bamboozled long enough, we tend to reject any evidence of the bamboozle. We're no longer interested in finding out the truth. The bamboozle has captured us. It's simply too painful to acknowledge, even to ourselves, that we've been taken. Once you give a charlatan power over you, you almost never get it back. And that is a point that kind of gets brought up over and over again on this show and in lots of conversations with people. I like to say that culture in the U.S. and to a lesser degree worldwide now is kind of at this point of being post-truth. Like the truth really just doesn't matter. Stephen Colbert, you know, popularized this talking about truthiness. And while he was coming from a comic perspective, it's really true that that's what's more important, is having this kind of air of confidence and officiality and expertise. And that will carry you through whatever the facts may be. And since there's a pummeling of constant distraction, even issues which cause pretty broad moral outrage, you know, war issues, torture by U.S. officials that we talked about last week, every story on the Project Censored list that we talked about 2 weeks ago, all of that becomes kind of this passing, fleeting thing. And if you never find out about the truth about it, well, that's just normal. You know, it's not, you don't usually find out the truth. So one becomes accustomed to that. And as Sagan says, rejecting any evidence of the bamboozle. I really like his use of the word bamboozle. So back to the cannabis issue. basically, my big issue with I-502 is that, I mean, my big broad issue with it is that I don't believe there should be any drug prohibition whatsoever by the government, because I don't think that anyone else should control what individuals can put into their own bodies. If they want to go into the woods and, you know, commit suicide by that plant that we talked about in the opening, that's their right to do so. And if they want to brew alcohol in their basement and drink it and potentially poison themselves, that's their prerogative. That's my personal opinion on the matter. No drug prohibition laws. But the reason that this law specifically is bad news bears, in my opinion, has a lot to do with this part that I have to find. First of all, you're taxed. The tax amounts, the excise taxes, are fairly high. 25% of the selling price between the producer and the processor, paid by the producer. 25% of selling price of usable infused product from a processor to a retailer, paid by the processor. And then 25% of the selling price between the retailer and the consumer, in addition to all applicable general state and local taxes and use taxes. So that becomes a pretty hefty amount, and it all goes into this dedicated marijuana fund, which pays for, let's find the dedicated marijuana fund line items. I know that part of it goes to pay for research at some of the larger universities. And that's fairly interesting for me. Sorry, I'm also scanning a list of Google searches to find this part that I'm looking for. So a little scattered. But so it goes to fund research on marijuana and its uses and effects, which has already been thoroughly researched over the last 50 years. And obviously scientific research is an ongoing process. But by this point, I mean, it should be at, you know, how can we become fuel independent using industrial hemp and solar? It shouldn't be, you know, does marijuana make kids stupid? Which is still a lot of the research that's going on today. And it's fairly ridiculous considering the broad impact that using this plant for all of its useful uses could be. So the monies will be dispersed. $125,000 will go to DSHS to, it says design a healthy youth survey, but I believe that it's actually to conduct the already existing healthy youth survey that's given to, I think, 8th, 10th, and 12th graders. I remember taking it every couple years, and it monitors youth trends in, you know, drug use, mental health, family health, nutrition, etc. And it's kind of how the state and the local health department keep track of what the kids are up to. And then the University of Washington will maintain and update scientifically accurate medicinal information on the health risks of the use of marijuana. No more than $1.25 million will go to the Liquor Control Board. 15% of the funds remaining will go to DSHS again, though this time toward programs to prevent substance abuse and substance dependence among middle and high school kids. Of this, at least 85% must go towards evidence-based, cost-effective programs which produce accurate and measurable results. 10% will go to the Department of Health so they can create public health programs which will educate about marijuana. This will include a marijuana use hotline, grant programs to health use which provide intervention strategies toward the usage of marijuana in youth, media-based education, advertisement about marijuana which targets youth, but may only use scientifically accurate information. I'm sure those will look very interesting considering what the scientifically accurate information is that has very little lasting issue for most people. Some go into the basic health plan trust account, 50% of the remaining funds. And that's about it there. But the part that they don't discuss, they don't talk about in this article. I don't know where the one I found earlier went, but it has disappeared from the internet. Most of this revenue generated is going to be generated through arrests and ticketing folks for DUIs related to marijuana. And it's going to cost a lot to train these officers in detecting marijuana intoxication in drivers, which you'd think would already be part of the training. just to detect intoxication in general. If someone's driving erratically, it's pretty hard to tell as a police officer or a passerby whether they're intoxicated on meth or marijuana or alcohol or whatever the substance may be. So that's a little strange to me. And the real issue that I'm sure you've likely heard about, because it was one of the biggest things that the no on I-502 folks were talking about, is the arbitrary nature of the DUI provision. So I'm going to find that information. Also, I thought I had all of this pulled up, and I do not now. So I'm sorry. Let's see. So we're going to scroll down to DUI. The initiative sets a per se DUI limit of Delta 9 THC levels at greater than or equal to 5 nanograms per milliliter of blood. State and local law enforcement agencies are tasked with enforcing the DUI limit. So, the issue with that is that the way that THC is stored in the body is in fat cells. And basically, it's stored at different rates depending on an individual's metabolism and a lot of other factors. So for some people, they could have smoked 2 or 3 weeks ago. They could have smoked one marijuana cigarette, which is the example that's often used. For some, that might be completely gone, you know, when they get pulled over for speeding 2 weeks later, and the officer decides that they're suspicious of, you know, that they're suspicious that this person's under the influence of marijuana, for which I haven't seen what the standards are going to be to detect that. If it's going to be one of the scenes where the officer can claim that they smell marijuana, you know, any number of issues like that. And for someone else who smoked that same one cigarette with their friend maybe 2 weeks before and they get pulled over, if they're tested because there's a suspicion that they're intoxicated, it could still be in their system and not be in their friend's system. So it's kind of an arbitrary amount. It's expensive. You have to, you know, draw blood to test this in the way that they want to test it. So it's going to be an expensive process. And really, it's difficult. And I've heard of at least a few law enforcement personnel who don't like it because it kind of puts a weird responsibility on them to detect whether or not people are under the influence. And that really opens the door for a lot of corruption, things that we've seen with other issues with police time and time again, most prominently racial profiling, especially considering that it's a 21 and up restriction and you can't breathalyze on site. So who's to stop the, you know, racist cop from pulling over 19-year-old, you know, brown teenage boys and deciding that they all need to be tested and charged with the DUI, have their license revoked, etc. So I just think it's a slippery slope. I think it's kind of gross. And yeah, that's my opinion on the whole thing. I want to get more into this general pseudoscience stuff, but I also have a pretty funny, I guess it's not that funny, but even, I mean, just to show the level of conversation about marijuana prohibition, even Ann Coulter, who's like the conservative yucky person of all conservative yucky people for a lot of folks, there's this debate on, let's see, what show is this on Geraldo Rivera's show with Ann Coulter and Cheech and Chong, and it's only a few minutes long, and I think I'm just gonna play it because it kind of shows she's even really non-committal about the whole thing, and it just kind of shows that across the so-called political spectrum in mainstream politics, this has almost become a non-issue, and yet the federal government's very hesitant to cede any control of it. So I'm just going to play this quick interview. It opens, and Geraldo Rivera's introducing the topic. We have Cheech Marin and Tommy Chong, you know, famous marijuana-based comedians of the 70s. It's just before their Get It Legal tour in 2009 and 2010. And Ann Coulter and a woman whose name I don't remember, who's a former prosecutor, and she talks about that a little bit. So here's that clip.
When he went to jail, A, that you two would reunite and that your concert tours would be absolutely sold out to a brand new generation.
That's amazing. We were actually working together when he got busted. We were working on a script, and then he got sent to jail. And then when he came out, we started slowly inching. But I knew that the tour would be successful because we get accosted every day on the street with the generations of fans. That's why I knew it would be successful in some regard. As successful, I didn't have any idea.
But I remember during the Reagan era of Just Say No, you guys were really beleaguered in many ways. You almost disappeared from the public scene.
Yeah. I moved to Europe. I went to Europe, and we did a couple of movies over there.
All right, so quickly, the interface with the Get It Legal and the marijuana policy project.
Well, we're trying to kick it off the cliff, you know.
When does it start?
Now.
It starts...
January 16th.
Yeah. January 16th. Okay, so you're 22 cities, yeah. Mm-hmm. This next leg, and you really want to get the issue onto the front burner.
What we want to do, we want to promote change through laughter.
Yeah.
Because it's our position that the marijuana laws are so ridiculous. You got to laugh at them. And that's what we did. Up in Smoke really was us laughing at the laws. You know, we had the narc, Stadenko, you know.
Stacey Keach, our old neighbor.
The laws are laughable and ridiculous.
So you would seek to make it equal to alcohol, say.
Yeah. I'd like to get it moved from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2.
Schedule 2. Available by prescription only.
By prescription only?
Yeah.
Ann Coulter, any problems with that?
Don't make me be the killjoy.
Come on, Buzzkill, let's go.
You're very funny comedians, but I'm still against legalizing pot, and I don't think they were laughing about the laws. They were laughing at you guys. You're very funny. Yeah.
Why don't you want to legalize?
I mean, he just said you want it like alcohol. Huh? Look, alcohol, I think, can be more different. You can drink alcohol without getting drunk, but you don't let that genie out of the bottle. I mean, there are a lot of problems with alcoholics, so you don't want two of them. As I told you last time, and okay, you're somewhat to the contrary, but not entirely. Everybody I know who needs pot because they're going through chemo or whatever, or they just like it, have no trouble getting it and don't get busted. And if anybody was ever going to get busted, you have to say you were waving a big red flag.
But Kimberly, it is a fact that marijuana arrests are the most common drug arrests, and they take up a disordinate portion of time of law enforcement energy and resources right here in New York City, a liberal bastion.
50% of the inmates in prisons are there for drugs.
For me, my focus obviously in prosecuting cases was always for violent offenders. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't something that I personally felt committed to in terms of narcotics prosecutions in that area. And they're right, it is an important distinction, Schedule 1 versus, you know, Schedule 2. And again, I come from the San Francisco DA's office, you know, so my boss there is a big supporter.
Big pothead?
it's quasi-legal now. I mean, yeah. I can walk out of the studio here, light up a joint, walk down the street. And right.
I don't know about New York.
The big difference is there are enlightened
people. You can ask him for his autograph.
People like in San Francisco, like in New York. Like in Los Angeles, they're enlightened people, and then there are people that are afraid of everything, you know, in the country, the side,
I have noticed on this issue, I get no hate mail, and on every ideological issue, a philosophical issue, I get bombarded, and why aren't the conservatives so angry about this?
Well, come on.
Are they potheads? Are they secret?
If I'm going to rank all the insane things you say, Geraldo, I got to tell you, pot's way above.
Low on the pole.
Okay, that's quite enough Fox News yuckery, but I just wanted to play that in, you know, really to support the point that in this case, the federal government is behind not only public opinion, as it always has been, I think, but even behind conservative punditry opinion. So it's pretty abysmal if you're at that point. And I'm going to get back to Carl Sagan because listening to Ann Coulter's voice kind of depressed me, and especially watching the video. She looks strikingly like Lady Gaga, which I never noticed until right now. Back to the matter at hand. Another Carl Sagan quote, also from the book The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark. Today we're talking about marijuana law, pseudoscience in the government, occultism, critical thinking, and everything in between. So this is Carl Sagan. I have a foreboding of an America in my children's or grandchildren's time, now, when the United States is a service and information economy, when nearly all the manufacturing industries have slipped away to other countries, when awesome technological powers are in the hands of a very few, and no one representing the public interest can even grasp the issues. When the people have lost the ability to set their own agendas or knowledgeably question those in authority, when, clutching our crystals and nervously consulting our horoscopes, our critical faculties in decline, unable to distinguish between what feels good and what's true, we slide, almost without noticing, back into superstition and darkness. The dumbing down of America is most evident in the slow decay of substantive content in the enormously influential media, the 30-second sound bites, now down to 10 seconds or less, lowest common denominator programming, credulous presentations on pseudoscience and superstition, but especially a kind of celebration of ignorance. So that's Carl Sagan, and that quote it's from the 1995 book, and I think that it's pretty prescient today and really even more relevant as he's talking about awesome technological powers in the hands of a very few, while almost everyone, you know, owns an iPhone. Not almost everyone, but many Americans own something like an iPhone or an iPad. They take advantage of this awesome technology, but how many really understand how it's working, are in control of how it's working, is no one. The percentage of the population that really understands things like, you know, computer networking and coding, computer programming, etc., on a more than rudimentary level is next to none. And yet it's part of everyone's daily life that they take for granted. So it kind of creates this elite wizard class almost, you know, if you think about the IT guy in an office building, because of the lack of information available to the average person working in the office, you know, the IT guy or girl seems to be this magical creature who can fix all of your technological problems, and you don't really have to do it because someone else knows how to do it. And that's sort of the crux of how our entire society has played out. Van and I talked about this in the education episodes we did together, just the splitting of skills and the compartmentalization of knowledge. So there's experts on certain things, but as far as democratic skills and knowledge and things like popular science, you know, actual popular science, are pretty much in decline in America. And Carl Sagan has something to say about that as well. And I want to bring up a specific example of some pseudoscience stuff that's been annoying to me lately. He says, "I worry that, especially as the millennium edges nearer," again, this is from 1995, "pseudoscience and superstition will seem year by year more tempting, the siren song of unreason more sonorous and attractive. Where have we heard it before? Whenever our ethnic or national prejudices are aroused, in times of scarcity, during challenges to national self-esteem or nerve, when we agonize about our diminished cosmic place and purpose, or when fanaticism is bubbling up around us, then habits of thought familiar from ages past reach for the controls. The candle flame gutters. Its little pool of light trembles. Darkness gathers. The demons begin to stir." That's the introduction to this book that I was talking about, Science's Candle in the Dark, The Demon-Haunted World. And he's talking about, you know, science is really the thing that can save the world, you know, in his opinion, because unlike religion, occultism, etc., science demands that you prove your claim. And if you can't prove it, and no one else can, and it can be disproven, then you move on. That's how science works. It's an accumulation of everyone else's knowledge that's been tested, proven or disproven, and then built upon. You don't see a religion that works that way, you know, and often religion is aggressively anti-disproving its hypothesis. You know, you hear about the kind of renegade nuns, the story in the Inlander a while ago that I believe Leah Sottil did, talking about these nuns who want to break from the tradition in some ways of the Catholic Church, and they get totally ostracized for questioning the dogma, which... And they were doing it saying, like, look at what science says. We need to adjust our position based on what science says, basically admitting this is provable and what you priests are saying is not provable. So science is really awesome for that reason. I guess, is what I have to say about it. And so he talks about this, and lately I have seen more stuff about ancient aliens and basically ancient aliens and like extraterrestrial inputs being what makes humans able to understand things, and that the aliens are coming to save us from the impending disaster, and ideas like this that are kind of just, you know, mystical and strange. The idea that somehow the year 2012 coming is just going to, something's going to magically happen to get the world out of the situation that humans have put it in through making unsound judgments over time, and then not correcting those unsound judgments, mostly at the hands of large governments. So an example, fossil fuels. The Industrial Revolution kicks off. We have all this coal, and then we have oil, and it seems cheap, and it seems like it's going to flow forever. And it, you know, we can see scientifically at the time that it has some negative effects, that the pollution, you know, is kind of making the air gross and the water. And over time, we start to mitigate those effects in small ways, you know, putting filters and such, covering up the area where the coal is shoveled in a train. Small improvements, but still operating on the premise that this stuff's going to last forever and that it's awesome and that the benefits outweigh the negatives. Then, you know, science marches on, because science doesn't stop when, you know, a new economic, global economic system emerges because of a scientific discovery. Science doesn't stop there. But the people who are making money off of the old science do stop there because it's making them money. Science progresses and learns that, oh, all of this stuff that we're dumping into the atmosphere due to the burning of fossil fuels, we're adding more carbon. It's bad news. Scientists say this, but the people who are in charge of the media mouthpiece, as Sagan points out, etc., basically can pay other people to say, no, real science is wrong, and here's my kind of shoddy fake science that you, consumer, can't tell the difference between because you aren't using the scientific method in your daily life, you don't have very high critical thinking skills, and you're going to be fooled. You know, we're going to pull the wool over your eyes, and we're going to continue our destructive practice that's destructive to the concept of much life on Earth, you know, has destroyed species, etc. We're going to keep doing it because you don't know any better. That's pretty much the premise, and that's a large reason that Sagan and others, including myself today, really advocated the popularization of science. I believe I have a quote of his that talks about 95%. Where is it? Maybe not. So then we see the rise of like the History Channel and Discovery Channel, owned by, I believe at least the History Channel is a News Corp company. I don't know that for sure, but they're both part of these large media empires owned by six different people. Most of the media is owned by six people. Think about that whenever you watch cable television or consume any mainstream media. One of six people has carefully chosen what messages are and aren't allowed to go out on that, and they each have a very specific agenda. They're all tied into the agenda of keeping their power intact. Don't forget that. And so we see Discovery Channel and History Channel, which a lot of people have historically looked to as, you know, reliable places to get interesting information. That's kind of what we think of when we think of popularized science, is the Discovery Channel. But then we see things like ancient aliens unveiled and secret coded messages in the Bible about the end times. And it's like, how did this end up on a channel that's purporting to promote science, talking about trying to decode an ancient text that doesn't have any history of being scientifically attacked, you know, or proven or disproven, to look for messages of the end times, rather than looking at the real science that kind of supports that type of an apocalyptic direction, and what can be done about it, something practical. So I think the real issue, again, you know, it comes, I think almost every issue I look at, it all comes back to education. and how is this kind of intense dumbing down and, you know, post-truth, truthiness era possible at all, I think it's really through the education system that we have. But one thing, so I'll just go into that. So, and I think the way children are treated is so important in the way that they're allowed to develop really sets the tone for the future of a society. That's what's said all the time by, the government, by really everyone. Everyone likes to invoke the name of the children to sanctify their cause. You know, think of the children. What about the children? And we saw this in this I-502 marijuana legalization campaign. On both sides, the yes side was saying, well, we can tax this and pay for things for the children. We'll have a better world for the children. And the no side was saying, protect the children. They can't be exposed to this horrible, horrible drug. They'll be addicted to heroin the next day after they try marijuana. So everyone likes to invoke the children, but the children don't have any say legally. They're actively discouraged from gaining any kind of autonomy. Self-exploration is basically nullified in the school system that we have. And this is what Carl Sagan has to say about it. We're going to go back to Carl Sagan all day today. He says, an extraterrestrial being newly arrived on Earth, scrutinizing what we mainly present to our children in television, radio, movies, newspapers, magazines, the comics, and many books, might easily conclude that we are intent on teaching them murder, rape, cruelty, superstition, credulity, and consumerism. We keep at it, and through constant repetition, many of them finally get it. What kind of society could we create if instead we drummed into them science and a sense of hope? So that's Carl Sagan. Basically he had a nice knack of kind of pointing out the uncomfortable elephants in the room. People these same save the children type of folks like to point out that there's violence in these video games and we're giving our children all these bad things, but, they continue to perpetuate the system, which is basically a dominant, concentrated capitalism setting the agenda for children and adults alike, which leads to that kind of propagation of smut for children and violence. You know, it's only because there's money to be made out of it, and its very survival depends on a complicit population who will continue to participate in things like murder, rape, cruelty, superstition, and consumerism. So if we don't get that into the children early enough, they won't grow up to be adults who can appropriately keep the gears turning and keep the system going at all costs, despite the fact that it's scientifically disastrous. If you look at it from an objective point of view, the direction that the society goes in can only lead to disaster. Unless, as Sagan says, drummed into the children science, which at its core, all science is posing a hypothesis and looking at data and conducting experiments to find if your hypothesis is true or untrue. That's science, and kids want to do it, and kids do it all the time. And Carl Sagan goes on to say, I find many adults are put off when young children pose scientific questions, which they do constantly. Why is the moon round? The children ask. Why is grass green? What is a dream? How deep can you dig a hole? When is the world's birthday? Why do we have toes? Too many teachers and parents answer with irritation or ridicule, or quickly move on to something else. What did you expect the moon to be? Square? Children soon recognize that somehow this kind of question annoys the grown-ups. A few more experiences like it, and another child has been lost to science. Why adults should pretend to omniscience before six-year-olds, I can't for the life of me understand. What's wrong with admitting that we don't know something? Is our self-esteem so fragile? So, again, Carl Sagan. These are all from The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark. It's his 1995 book, intended to explain the scientific method to lay people and encourage people to learn critical or skeptical thinking. It explains methods to help distinguish between ideas that are considered valid science and ideas that can be considered pseudoscience. Sagan states that when new ideas are offered for consideration, they should be tested by means of skeptical thinking and should stand up to rigorous questioning. He actually has the last, one of the last chapters in the book is a baloney detection kit. That's the title of the chapter. And he provides a lot of tools, basic logical fallacies to look out for, logical and rhetorical fallacies, argument from authority, statistics of small numbers, and then how learning to do independent confirmation of facts. You know, how do you find if information is true or not? And he wrote this before the widespread availability of the internet. So I would have loved for Carl Sagan to live another 10 years and be able to incorporate that, because YouTube has propagated pseudoscience at an alarming rate. That's the risk. I'm not saying we shouldn't do this, but the risk of democratizing media in the way that YouTube does is there's, you know, it's an equalizer, which means it equalizes the real science with the pseudoscience. There's considerably more, I think, pseudoscience, or it's more popular because it's comforting. It's comforting to this like primal part of humans that wants safety and security and the notion that like there's something that we can't ever understand and maybe someday it will swoop in and save all of us, even though it's not provable and it's really not a productive direction to look in for anything. So this is another, I wish I could read, I don't think there's much on Sagan talking about the school system, other than he thinks it should be more exploratory, which is just simply true. To expect children to sit in a room with only their peers, you know, having to ask permission to use the bathroom, to ask permission to ask a question, and to speak at all, in fact, and then to be expected to absorb information in a non-participatory format, which is the bulk of what education is. You know, it's the input of endless data and facts without really working on the processor. Like, that's what children should be developing at that age. If you were to compare the kid to a computer, you know, what it needs is more processing power, like more critical thinking ability, so it can better analyze and chop up the data that you're feeding to it. But instead, the school system kind of looks at the child, you know, the computer child, and just wants to add more memory, just more space to the hard drive so they can fill it with information. And, you know, if that crashes it, then, oh, well, you know, we need to just find that computer's gone now and we need to find a new one and build it. You know, that's called a dropout. And, you know, it wouldn't fill with data anymore, so it's discarded, rather than working on like enhancing the processing power of the student. So, and this is the last Sagan quote that I'm going to share. And it's definitely hits home for me, having gone through the 12-year primary secondary school thing in modern America. He says, "Every now and then I'm lucky enough to teach a kindergarten or first grade class. Many of these children are natural-born scientists, although heavy on the wonder side and light on skepticism. They're curious, intellectually vigorous, provocative and insightful questions bubble out of them. They exhibit enormous enthusiasm. I'm asked follow-up questions. They've never heard of the notion of a dumb question. But when I talk to high school seniors, I find something different. They memorize facts. By and large, though, the joy of discovery, the life behind those facts, has gone out of them. They've lost much of the wonder and gained very little skepticism. They're worried about asking dumb questions. They're willing to accept inadequate answers. They don't pose follow-up questions. The room is awash with sidelong glances to judge, second by second, the approval of their peers." That quote shows really better than anything else I can share what I believe is the true purpose of compulsory schooling that we have in the U.S. It's to socialize and to kind of normalize conformity for adolescents, which are a group of people that are traditionally non-conforming. And without a mandatory mechanism like the schooling that we have, I would contend that it would be nearly impossible to control such a group. There's a John Taylor Gatto quote that truly educated people are simply not manageable. And that's really the root of the issue. So would truly educated people accept the prohibition of a harmless plant substance? That's really the question of today's show. So thanks for joining me on kind of a rambling hour there. Carl Sagan, Ann Coulter, marijuana prohibition, Cheech and Chong, occultism, ancient aliens. Just some of the topics brought to you today on Praxis. Thank you for listening. I'll be back next week talking to David Brookbank, recently returned from Nicaragua, about some of the politics and interesting history down there and how it might apply to life in the U.S. for all of us. Thanks for listening, and the podcast will be up later on KYRS.org along with an archive of former shows. Have a great day. You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.